Welcome back into Play-by-Play Cast. It is the podcast about play-by-play broadcasters for play-by-play broadcasters and hosted by a play-by-play broadcaster, a professional development podcast that dives into the tips, tricks, experience, stories, process, and preparation of some of the biggest and best play-by-play announcers in the business. Today, we head down south to the SEC and visit with the voice of Mississippi State. Neil Price is on the show. First off, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you. This is a bit surreal because I told you in trading emails, long-time listener, first-time appearance. But I'm glad, number one, that you're back. And I don't know if enough people that are on here will you tell you this or not, because I'm sure a lot of them are like me. They've listened. I think you're providing a great service for the people who do what we do, because we're all nerds to a degree about this. And I really enjoy hearing the perspective of other people and the nuts and bolts of how they do this game in and game out, sport in, sport out, et cetera. And I think you've got the gold standard with regard to the people who are doing this and the people you're getting to come on and talk about it. Now, it tarnishes a little bit with me today, but beyond that, I think it's been wonderful. And I can't tell you how happy I am that it's been back since January. So thank you for having me. I'm flattered to be.
No, my pleasure, Neil, and thank you for taking the time, because it's never lost on me that people actually say yes and are willing to do this. So we'll see where it takes us today. This is a question I ask to athletes a lot. I don't think I've ever asked it on this podcast, but I think it's an interesting place to start. Why do you do this?
That is a great question. So the only thing I can figure, Joel, is that I grew up in rural East Tennessee. And I spent a lot of time with my mom's mother, my grandmother, who grew up during the Depression, who grew up in a very rural area where entertainment was going and gathering with other people and just talking and telling stories about what was going on in life. As morbid as this may sound, going to the funeral home was a big deal from my grandmother, because sometimes it was the only other opportunity they had to see other people and interact with them on a regular basis when some life-changing event happened. So I grew up around someone who loved to talk. My mother inherited that, her side of the family inherited that. And I guess by default, I inherited that too. I saw my elementary school principal 2 weeks ago. I went to the SEC tournament in Nashville. And on the way up, my high school, for the first time in my lifetime, qualified for the state basketball tournament, only the second time in the history of the school. So the TSSAA, the High School Association in Tennessee, I went to college with some of the assistant commissioners. They're wonderful people. They said, if you'd like to do the game, we'll hold it for you. Yeah, I'd like to do that. I'd like to see my team in the state tournament, and I'd like to do the game. Yeah, that would be a blast. But after the game, I saw a bunch of friends that I went to high school with, some I hadn't seen in 20 years, and my elementary school principal, who said to me, all of those unsatisfactory marks that we put down for the ability to control unnecessary talking when you were in school, somehow we feel like we have held you back in some way, and that we're glad you were able to overcome that. And I got a chuckle out of it, but that was my upbringing. That's where I came from. And I realized at an early age, probably sixth, seventh grade, I was not going to be an athlete. I would have loved to have been, but I was not going to be. All of my friends were above average athletes. And if I wanted to continue to spend time and be around them, I was going to have to find another way, because being on the floor, being on the field with them just wasn't realistic. So for me, it was being the PA announcer at the basketball games in seventh and eighth grade in middle school. And my parents would take me and drop me off, or I'd stay after school when we had home games, and I'd introduce the starters. I would tell the crowd who made baskets. I did all those things, and it carried over into high school. And then I got into radio at 15, and, you know, it turned into junior college basketball after high school, and eventually on into college. So it all stems from the people I grew up with and family and, you know, roots, I guess, and the desire to want to be around my friends. That's the best answer I can give you.
You have called games at Kyle Field and Alabama and, I mean, cathedrals of college football, but where does broadcasting a game of your high school in the state championship tournament rank in your professional career when you've been gone for a couple of decades and getting to go back?
It's up there because it was the only thing I ever wanted to do when I was in high school, Joel. That was it. I was the PA announcer on Friday nights, and I was about three seats down from the two guys who did the games on the radio, and I always wanted to do it. And they were kind to take me and let me read stats at halftime for road games and help carry the gear and set it up and maybe do some things after the game, post game. But I never got to do one of the games. Did some baseball games in high school, but never got to do football or basketball. So it's up there to the point, and, you know, I can be emotional at times. I told you I went to college with a couple of the assistant commissioners. One of them is sitting beside of me producing the game, and he hands me the sponsor for the starting lineup, and they're getting ready to introduce my high school team, and all those people in orange and white stood up behind him across the way, and I looked at him, and I said, you're going to have to do this. I said, because that's my school, and they're here, and it's surreal, and I get to do this. Yeah, it's up there because it means something. It is deeply personal. It's home. It's all of those things. And I prepared and worked on that game, Joel, as hard as I would on any SEC game because it meant something to me. And I knew there would be people in my hometown who couldn't be there who were listening. And I wanted it to be special for them, too. And the notes and the cards after, I was blown away. Absolutely blown away. Now, the team got beat by 20. That's unfortunate. But it's still – it'll be one of my all-time memories, all time.
That's awesome. You know, it's interesting because I've the way that you phrased that answer and the way I've heard you talk about what you do in some other interviews and being the connection and the voice and the person for the people that can't get to the games. I feel like we live in an era now where people don't think of radio as much as they used to, because everybody thinks of live streams and they think of television I'm as guilty as that as anybody. But what is it that you feel makes radio to this day something that is still so important, especially to sports and especially to communities, that makes what the radio broadcaster does so important and impactful?
Well, I'm in the Deep South, and Mississippi is a very rural state. A lot of the states in the Southeastern Conference are rural states. They have rural economies. It's not realistic for someone to pack up on a Saturday and bring their family to a football game because there are crops to be tended to or things that have to be done. I'm not sure that high-speed internet is totally accessible in our part of the world. It is here in the college town, but I mean, I'm not sure that it's realistic to believe that everyone has high-speed internet, that they can stream the game on television, or if in the case of my parents, I'll be honest with you, my parents are, you know, in late 60s, early 70s. They don't understand technology the way that people my age at 43 or your age do, and radio is still something that they can relate to. I think all those things come into play. And the other thing for me is that the people that I learned from, Joel, and the people I tried to be around, they either came from second generation play-by-play, or they learned from the people who were second generation play-by-play announcers who followed Bill Stern and Graham McNamee, who listened to them when they were young, and then brought that into what would be the golden era of college sports on radio, probably from the 60s up through when every game started appearing on television in the 90s. So I just learned from those guys that that's your job. Your job is to be the eyes of the people who can't be there, to relay the message, to tell them what's happening. And if you don't do that, I think you're failing people who are listening in some way. The other piece of it too, I think, is that radio now has become this companion piece in some ways to video, because there's still a great many people who want to hear their team's perspective of what's happening. So they do still mute the stream or audio or the video, and they'll put our audio with it. And I think that's a great compliment when people will do that, because we are with the team every day. We don't just drop in for a game once a week. We're around them. We should know what's going on. So doesn't necessarily make us homers, but occasionally we have information that maybe someone else doesn't. So all that plays into my philosophy behind why it's important. And I just think, too, it is the most intimate medium. I've always believed that. When you think about the great broadcasters in history, Vin Scully, Jack Buck, I was a huge fan of Marty Brenneman with the Reds. If you sat down in your car, if you sat on your back porch, you felt like they were talking directly to you. There was a connection. I don't think television provides that same thing. And it's the reason I love radio. It's a chance to connect with people on a very personal level.
There's something that I think jives with that, and that makes a lot of sense when you consider that answer. Saw your appearance on Broadcaster Hour a couple of years ago, and you broke out your charts. And I know you have some of them with you here today too. And one thing that struck me interestingly was you held up your football chart, and you didn't have a ton of statistics on it. You had the important ones, but you didn't write out everybody's every single statistic on every single line, because at some point, and I mean, you could say it better than I can repeat it, but like, what is stat X, Y, and Z if you don't have some sort of greater story to tell that goes along with it? And at some point it becomes numbers. And especially for younger people in this field, a lot of times we get beholden to the numbers are the story, the numbers are the important part, and that's what we talk about, and that's where we live. But when I listen to what you just said too, there's such an emotional connection. And it's almost like, yeah, the numbers are great, and they might tell you that John Doe is a great player, but what is most essential to what we do is who these people are and creating that emotional connection. Is that how you feel like you approach what you do day in and day out?
Yes. And I can't take total credit for that approach, Joel. I can't. There are two people who helped me realize that. I did college baseball for 15 years. And when I got to Kentucky, somewhere about midway through my run there, I got to meet Marty Brenneman. And Marty was very kind to me, let me come and shadow he and Steve Stewart at that time and Joe Nuxall. And just to be in a booth with people like that was a real treat. But to watch him work was really something, because it's choreographed and you can just tell they're around the team every day. They're at the batting cage. They knew everything. And they didn't care about that box score that had the batting averages and the home runs and the walks and strikeouts. Sure, it's important at a given time, but the bulk of their prep, as it appeared to me, and I wouldn't dare speak for them, was what they gathered in the clubhouse and what they gathered at the batting cage. And Marty Brenneman told me in a phone conversation after one time, I was asking, hey, how can I be a better baseball announcer? And he said, don't beat people over the head with statistics. You can provide any number under the sun. And sure, it might sound great, but what does it mean? Does the average fan know what WAR is? Do they know what WHIP is? And it made a lot of sense to me. It really did. So instead, his advice to me was go to the batting cage. Go to the batting cage every day. Talk to people. Hang out. You'll be amazed at what you'll learn. And it was one of my favorite parts of doing baseball. The game itself was a blast, but going to the cage was wonderful, because I'd learn something about a mechanic. I would learn something about what a guy had changed, what the coaching staff had been working on a particular hitter with that I would never have picked up otherwise. And I'm not smart enough to pick it up just watching the game, because I didn't play it at a high level. So the other piece is, you know, as it relates to football, I talked to Brad Nessler. Brad and Kevin Harlan kind of came up at the same time. They have similar approaches to their prep in football, just based on what I get. And some of it comes from listening to your show. You know, you had Kevin Harlan on early, and I remember listening to that one because I was fascinated how he was able to do it. And I kind of married their football charts together in their own way to make one that worked for me. And what Brad Nessler did in terms of statistics for television was very, very simple. How many touchdowns does a guy have rushing or passing? How many yards or how many yards per game? But you don't need every single number. You only need the numbers, I think, if they are exceptional, because people want to know who that person is under their helmet or who they are outside of when they're on the court in a basketball game or on the field during a baseball game. You know, now in the NFL, I think that's completely different. And in the NBA, I think it's completely different. Charles Davis has become a friend. I think Charles is one of the great, you know, color analysts in football. And I remember asking him at an event he did here in Mississippi. I said, what's the difference, Charles, in when you're doing a college game and you're doing a professional game? And he told me, and I think Kevin Harlan helped him with this. I don't want to put words in someone's mouth, but in college, fans want to know who the person is when they're not on the field. They want to know them on a personal level. In professional sports, the fan wants to know, how does this impact my fantasy team? How does it impact the wager I have on the game? And that's where the statistics become much more important than maybe they are in the world that I live in. That made a lot of sense to me too. So that's a long, convoluted answer to how and why, but that's the logic behind it.
No, it's actually, I've never thought of that distinction. And I think people talk all the time, what's different between college and the pros, and what's different between covering those two things. That's a fairly good articulation of what the difference is. And especially in college, because you don't know the people, like they rotate through. And, you know, I don't necessarily know that people need to be told who LeBron is as much as they just care about what he's doing to help their team, their wallet, those types of things. As shallow as that sounds.
And that's a great way to look at it, because he's on television. He's in the media every single day when the season's going on and when it's not. So you don't have to reintroduce the characters all the time at the professional level. I think that's a great way to put it.
You talked about being around the batting cage in baseball. Did you ever have days where you said nothing? You just stood there and watched or like what's that? Cause I would have times where I would stand at the cage and I'd be like, I kind of like being here. I'm learning a ton. I don't know if they're looking at me sideways. How did you ingrain yourself in that, that environment, and also kind of be a fly on the wall instead of maybe being a part of the action, if that makes sense?
Well, I'm backward by nature. So my approach was always, I'm stepping into their world, stay out of the way, speak when spoken to. If I am invited to step up on the back of the shell and stand there and watch, I would take advantage of that. I would never assume that I was welcome to just go and do that. And what I learned, Joel, is the longer that I was around, I think that the coaches and to an extent, the players, you know, when you're in college, I don't know that you're thinking about earning people's trust, or you're not necessarily, you know, paranoid about a lot of things. Social media was still relatively new in that day. And I just think, you know, those guys realize, hey, you're interested in what we're doing. You care because you'd come down here. It's real easy on a hot day in May to sit up there in an air-conditioned booth and just look over stats and do whatever and fill out your scorecard and not go stand down there in the heat with those guys. But I think it means something to them. So that was my approach to it. A lot of days I didn't say a word. Again, it comes back to, I don't know what they do. So it would be more beneficial to me to stand in silence, speak when spoken to, and watch and observe and listen than it would be for me to go down there with these grand ideas that I know more than they do about this game, and I'm going to tell them about it. I just think you turn people off that way. they may think differently of me because I don't say a lot and because I'm a little bit aloof in that way, but it's respectful more than anything. I'm in their world. I'm appreciative of being there. I'm going to stay out of their way and let them work.
What's your best Mike Leach story?
Oh, wow. Number one, career highlight. I'll never, if I do this another 30 years, there'll never be another one. He was getting to know him just a little. And it's my opinion, there were only a small handful of people who really knew Mike Leach. And the rest of us were just in some kind of orbit around him. The first one that comes to mind is one of the first interactions I ever had with him. State hired Mike Leach during COVID. So there was no spring game the first year that Coach got hired. So the second year, 21, State's going to have spring game scaled back. About 2 weeks after that, my wife and I are going to take a vacation to Yellowstone. So Mike Leach is from Cody, Wyoming. And I'm going out to do the interview for the spring game with him after a practice on a Thursday or Friday afternoon at the facility. And I'd never had much one-on-one time with him at this point. And I said, hey, I don't want to keep you very long, but I'm going to Yellowstone in a couple weeks. I'm going to have a car. I don't know if I'll ever get back. I know you're from that part of the world. Would you mind spending a few minutes with me when we're done here and tell me what I need to see, what I need to do? Yeah. How long you got? Well, I'm not in any hurry. Okay, let's do this and we'll talk. So the interview's 5 minutes. We get that out of the way. 90 minutes later, we're standing in the middle of the turf practice field and we're talking about Yellowstone. So he looks at me immediately and he says, okay, partner, here's the deal. You're going to want to stay away from the bear, okay? Because when you get out there, the bear's going to be waking up after it's been asleep for 5-6 months. And it's going to be hungry. And don't take this the wrong way, but you're kind of big and you might taste good. So stay away from the bear, okay? And yes, sir. You know, and then there were stories about the Cody Museum of the American West, if we could have found a way to Cody, Wyoming. Unfortunately, we got there at the end of winter, so the roads were snowed over. We couldn't get that far. You're going to want to eat red meat. Try some bison. They're not big on green vegetables out there. It's a lot of potatoes. Your cholesterol will be high when you come back, but you're going to be happy. Okay. You know, he was wonderful. And the memorable conversations with him, Joel, were always about something other than football. I think he hated to talk about football outside of the office because it was his life. I think he was very passionate about it and doing it at a high level. No question about that. But he knew so much more. And I always found he was much more engaging when we would have conversations about anything other than football. A career highlight. I mean, again, I'll never work with a guy like that again. He was truly one of a kind. And I miss him. I didn't know him personally, but I miss him because when I showed up for that Thursday night radio show, I didn't know where the conversation was going, but I knew we were going to have a really good time for that hour. And one of my greatest regrets is the first 2 years I worked with him, I got it in my mind that I owed the fan base to hold this guy to talking about football for a little while. And the last year that I worked with him, I threw that plan out the window and just said, I'm going to talk to him about football for 8 minutes when he gets here, that first segment. And then we're going to take a break and we're going to go wherever he wants to go. And it was a much better show, much more entertaining. I wish I'd have done it earlier. I really do.
I would love to know what the conversation with your wife was like when she's like, and Neil, what'd you learn about what we need to do at Yellowstone? Mike says, stay away from the bear.
Yeah. He didn't say it exactly that way, but that's the PG version of how he said it. So
what was minute 9 of that radio show like? Like, I have to imagine it was fun, but also probably one of the more challenging things as a broadcaster to sit down and say, like, I got this guy. who can talk about anything and make it awesome. And I've got to facilitate that in a way that delivers for people that are listening and for ourselves as people on the show.
The pressure was off me. He delivered. It wasn't on me to get him to deliver. He just delivered. There was a sponsored feature by an eyewear company in town, and they would bring a display every week of oftentimes sunglasses. So we would have them on a display on a table between us, and I would read the card, and then I would ask him a question about what catches your eye here. And he would pick them up and start putting them on. Well, now these are Costas, you know, and I'm a big fan of Costas. You know, I'm not trying to get anybody to go buy them, but, you know, I've had lots of these, and I'm a big fan of the Ray-Bans. You know, the blue ones are great, you know, and there's something about if you got the right pair of Ray-Bans. Like when I was at Valdosta, I had these Ray-Bans that had these blue reflective lenses in them, and I'd put a hat on backwards. And if you stand there with those on and swell and smothering heat in August, and you cross your arms and you just stare at a guy, he thinks you mean business and he's not looking to cross you in some way. There's something to be said about that. And then one night it turned into, hey, those look like Jake Jarmel's glasses from Seinfeld. Yeah, they kind of do. And then it became, you know, if Kramer's not on that show, it's not any good. You know that, right? It's a terrible show. And it just turns into that. You know, one of the last ones we did, and I told this story at the memorial service. The breaks are 4 minutes. They're an eternity. So sometimes he's visiting with fans, which he was great to do. He would always sign autographs. Never once was it a burden. I always respected that about Mike Leach because everybody wanted a piece of it. But he's on his phone. So he's got his phone and he's just kind of doing this and we're in a break. Well, I knew he'd been taking a Spanish lesson a day. And I looked at him and I said, you taking your Spanish lesson? No, I'm looking at castles. I said, excuse me? I'm looking at castles. See, there's this website. It's like Zillow, but it's all castles. And they're all in Europe. And I guess the government's over there, they like give you a tax break because they just don't want to sit empty in case like squatters get in them or something. So they're trying to sell them to get people to buy them and fix them up. And he said, and you'd be surprised. They're a lot cheaper than you think. And he's scrolling through again and he finds, see, look, and he leans over to me and he shows me this one is just like you, stately and regal. And it's only $475 American. Now, I'm not telling you you're going to get, you know, indoor plumbing in a great kitchen, but I'm telling you, if you play your cards right, you might get a drawbridge and a moat. How cool would that be? And you're not just going to go down the corner to the store and buy your groceries. You're going to have to learn to eat venison and fish and, you know, you're going to have to work a little bit, but how cool would it be to have a castle? You know, he had this really childlike enthusiasm about things like that, that you couldn't help but just smile. And I think that's why people were drawn to him. I really do. I learned a lot about how to think about football from being around him now. And listen, this won't shock you that when you're talking about Mike Leach, that some concept of time and space or something that seems cosmic would be what comes from this. But I remember asking him one day, I said, you know, how do you game plan for something, or how do you do it? It's not hard, big guy. You just got to attack the space. You just got to find the space. That's all. And I'm thinking, I never looked at it that way. Never. But yeah. Okay. Fine. Throw it where they're not. It's just like baseball, hit it where they're not, throw it where they're not, you know, that's all. Make them cover the whole thing. It changed the way I look at football. It really does. So that 3-year stretch, I took it for granted. Absolutely. While it was going on, I think about it a lot, but there'll never be another 3-year stretch in my career like that. Never.
That's it's the experiences we get. Those are things that are very unique to this job that make it very cool. So jealous.
It's why it's important
that.
To be where your feet are.
Yeah.
It's why it's important to be, because I think that's the thing, especially when people are younger. Oh, wow. How am I going to get out of here and get to the next stop? Being where your feet are is important. some of my favorite memories were from junior college basketball. And the reason being, I was the same age as the guys and the young women who were playing. I was friends with a good many of them because I was going to class with them every day. And you could walk into a head coach's office, and we had two wonderful head coaches, Dave Craigle and Bill Carlisle. And you could just talk to them about anything, basketball or otherwise. They'd invite you to lunch with them. It's just not realistic when you get to this level. It's not. There's such a burden and demand on people's time that it doesn't happen. But those were good days. And I will tell you that I don't think I realized exactly how great they were until they were gone. Same thing, Middle Tennessee. Same thing. It was similar in some ways there to when I was in junior college in terms of the accessibility and being around people than it has been at, than you know, in not that way at Kentucky and at Mississippi State, just because, again, the demands and the time that people are asked to put in.
Talk to me about another set of experiences that you've had. It is Sweet 16, Elite Eight weekend. I remember when I was in college and my senior year, Syracuse went to the Sweet 16, and I was like, this is amazing. Can't wait until I'm broadcasting one of these professionally. Spent 10 years at a Division I school. It never happened. I think sometimes you take for granted what it's like to broadcast on that stage and that platform. What's it been like for you over the last 3 years to experience March Madness firsthand?
You know, it's really cool. And I've been able to go to the NC2A tournament with the team three times and seeing different places along the way. The first time was San Jose, 2018 or 19, I guess it was 2019 in San Jose, completely different, but with a head coach who had spent a lot of time in California, Ben Howland, who could help you understand some of the cultural differences in being in that part of the world. It's a, you know, San Jose was gorgeous. That whole Bay Area is unbelievable. The first four, I will tell you, the first four is a great event. And it should never leave Dayton. That's one of the reasons it's awesome. My first year at State went and played Dayton at UD Arena, and it was being renovated at that time. Folks, if you want to see college basketball in a great environment, UD Arena is sneaky good. You think about the blue blood programs, and I've seen games at those places too. UD Arena is up there with any of them when the Flyers are good. And that first four, the community just gets behind it. It's sold out. It's crazy to think that the teams can fill that place up. The community does it, and they care about it. That was a great event. And then Charlotte, I had never been to Charlotte to get to go to a new city. And I would tell you, it's one of the nicest big cities I've ever been to. One of the cleanest big cities I've ever been to. I loved walking around downtown and just kind of sightseeing and checking out some of the culture. That within itself was a lot of fun. The games are games. It's the experience that comes with it, getting to take in some of the local culture, sightsee a little bit. That's what makes it special. Now, as much as I love the NC2A tournament, I would still say one of my favorite basketball experiences, State made the NIT the first year I was here and made it all the way to New York. And I would tell you, I enjoyed that experience start to finish more maybe than the NC2A tournament, because I'm sitting on the floor at Madison Square Garden and I'm looking around going, how is this real right now? It was great. And I had been to New York City a couple times. That wasn't the first time there, but it was the first time in the Garden. Got to go with Bailey Howell, who is the greatest basketball player Mississippi State has ever produced, played for the Boston Celtics with Bill Russell, played for the Pistons. And I remember looking at Mr. Howell, who is in his 80s, and I said, how many times did you play at Madison Square Garden when you were the Celtics? And he's one of the rare people who could look back at me and go, which one? Because he played in the second Garden and the current one. Oh, yeah, and I got an education about that from a guy who lived it. That was a wonderful experience on so many levels. So listen, we get to do a fun job and it's great. But the things that the job gives back to us, I mean, come on. You know, it's just, it's not real life sometimes. It's not.
Let me backtrack from there to when you first got to Mississippi State, because one of the cool anecdotes I thought that I found from when you got the Mississippi State job was that that interview was done entirely on the phone, especially because they're hiring a radio voice. They want to know what the radio voice sounds like. But I also imagine there's some sort of like disconcerting part to that where you're trying to present yourself and you can't see these people and you don't get the maybe the feel for them in person or the ability to show yourself off in person the way that you typically would want to or think. What was it like for you to go through that process?
Okay, so context will clear a lot of that up for you. Keep in mind that I was at the University of Kentucky for 12 years. So I had been to Starkville. I had been to Mississippi State so many times in a 12-year stretch that I knew what I was getting into. My wife worked for the women's basketball program at Kentucky. So same thing. She knew where we were headed. She knew what it was. And the guy who was leading that interview, John Cohen, who was the AD here at that time, also was the first baseball coach I ever worked with at UK. So all those things kind of tied together. Now, there were three people in that interview who I had never met face to face. And John kind of sold it as, well, we're hiring a radio announcer. It's not really important how he looks. We just need to know how he sounds. And to my knowledge, Joel, I hate to speak out of school, but to my knowledge, I don't think any of the final four candidates, other than one who lived here, I don't think that any of them came to campus for an interview. That was the way that they did it. So I didn't have any reservations about where I might be headed or what it might be or any of that, because I had seen all of it. And I knew one of the people who was going to have a big hand in making that decision. So, you know, as scary as it may sound, it really wasn't at all.
What was it like for you? Obviously, you'd been at Kentucky for a little bit more than a decade, but to be the voice at an SEC school, when you got that phone call and it realized in your mind that this is happening, what did that feeling feel like?
Oh, it was a lot of things at one time. Clearly, there was some elation. Finally, you know, I've made it. I get to do this. What I always wanted to do. Was do games on the radio and do them in the SEC. You know, I think the other piece of it is as I got closer and closer to that Labor Day weekend in 2017 and that first game against Charleston Southern, there's some pressure of you better get this right. Don't screw this up. And, you know, I think I did okay. I've gotten a lot better since I've been here. I had done a grand total of one college football game when I got this job. So I've done plenty of high school games. And again, football is football. The players are bigger. They're faster. You know, there are more of them at this level. But the game at its core is the same. And as you develop a rapport and a comfort level with your teammates and with the people that you cover, I think all that stuff gets easier. So, you know, but the two big feelings were elation and fear. All at once. And now it's just, you know, go out and do the very best that you can and wash, rinse, and repeat, you know, because I feel like I'm in a pretty good rhythm in both sports, and I'm comfortable with how I go about what I do.
What was the biggest obstacle for you in getting comfortable calling football at a more grandiose level? And similarly combating that fear to feel like, I'm here. This is where I should be.
Well, I think the biggest fear is that, do you belong? You know, I had some insecurity about that because I was the new guy in the conference. And keep in mind, I grew up listening to a lot of different people in this league. I've been incredibly fortunate to become friends with a lot of them now, but Bob Kessling at Tennessee, I owe him my career. He got me started at a very early age and took an interest in me and has helped me at every stage of my career, helps me to this day. You know, and being at that point, you know, that first basketball game against Tennessee, and we're sitting at the same table and we're doing the same game. And I'm thinking, I'm not sure I belong here. Or Tom Leach, who's a great friend who I got to know at Kentucky over 12 years, same deal. First trip back to Rupp Arena. Man, I don't know that I belong in this deal, in this club. But over time, you realize that you do. And you just have to become comfortable with that part of it, that you're good enough. You've worked hard to get to that point in your career, and that, yeah, you do deserve a seat at the table. And once I was able to get past that step, I got better. That may not make sense, but that was the thing that was always tough for me, is that I just looked up to these guys, and I still look up to all of them, but it was just being there with them and not being starstruck that here you are at this level, or looking across the floor and seeing that that's Rick Barnes, or that's John Calipari, or that's, you know, whomever, Buzz Williams, or whomever, Ben Howland. And my guy is a guy who went to three straight Final Fours, and I got to interview this guy every day. Dan Mullen. I got to interview Dan Mullen every week before a football game. I had number one ranked team in the country, Mississippi State. Never happened before. That's the stuff for me that I had to overcome, develop some kind of comfort level with that. My partner on basketball games, Richard Williams, took Mississippi State to the Final Four in 1996 as a coach, and I got to make a good impression on this guy. You know, good basketball coach. And once you got past that, it became easier.
Tell me about all the other things you do as well, because that was the case at Kentucky. You did a lot of network managing and making sure that that operation ran smoothly. And then I know you get to Mississippi State, and you've done a handful of different things that are broadcast adjacent to your job as the voice of the Bulldogs. And I know now you run WMSU as well. So tell me about some of the other pieces that you do, how that is professionally fulfilling for you, and how that kind of fills your cup up.
Some of it isn't at all. And that's part of the reason I think that there are so many of those things on there, is I've kind of bounced around because it's been hard to find the right fit. At Kentucky, everything I did was related to the network and the broadcast. It was a full-time job. And, you know, I did the daily updates for the affiliates that went out, the 2.5 minute features. When the rights changed hands, I took over as the football producer and learned a lot from a guy named Mike Dodson, who had done that for years. Mike, in my opinion, is one of the great people in broadcasting that many people may not know about. He is a genius when it comes to producing. He hears the game differently than people because he's been around it. He can tell you the finite little things that can help you get from good to great. He taught me a lot about how to produce, because I'd never produced before. And, you know, going in a booth and getting people to read the right card at the right time in the game, and not forcing things, and getting them in and out of breaks and all that. I love that. I enjoyed it. And then the network management piece of it at Kentucky, I enjoyed too, because I got to know the people who carried our games and got to have a little bit of a relationship with them. That helped me get my high school football job when I was there. I did high school football for one of our affiliates that was in the next county over. And I will tell you, working with those people, they cared about doing local radio the right way and covering high school sports and being really passionate about it. And they treated me better than just about anybody I've ever done anything for, to come in one night a week and do a football game for them. Here, when I first took the job, it was a part-time job. It was a contract job. So I had to have some way to pick up benefits, health insurance primarily, and a little bit of retirement. So I had been here a few months. My wife was still in Lexington working for the women's basketball team at Kentucky to make sure we had health insurance. And the comm department on campus had a need for an instructor. So they called and asked if I had any interest in teaching. And I had never taught in my life. But sure, I'll try it. So I taught the practicum class, which was the capstone, senior level students. They did a newscast 2 days a week. and I taught a broadcast performance class. I was much more comfortable teaching performance than teaching folks how to do news on television. But it was an eye-opening experience for a couple of reasons. I think I learned how much I had grown in 15 years, probably at that point, since I'd gotten out of college. I learned that you cannot be a college instructor and approach anything from a customer service standpoint. That's not a good plan. And I've been able to use that in some of the other jobs since I've been here. I was a director of broadcasting for the network for a little while, had an opportunity to become a general manager for a few months with Hail State Plus, which was a subscription-based program. In theory, it felt like a good thing going in. I was never a good fit for that. I loved being in the athletic department every day. I've got a lot of friends on that side of it. I enjoyed being around them. It just wasn't a good fit for me, and it wasn't going to be good for them going forward. And luckily, I realized that. And then just lucked into becoming the general manager at the radio station because the previous GM wanted a change of pace. He'd been doing that for 7 years, and I think had worked at the station for about 12 or 15 and just wanted something different out of life. And that job opened, and I'd always kind of wanted to tinker with that. I grew up in a station, started out working in a station, reminded me a lot of that. And I thought, yeah, let's give this a run. And it has headaches, but they're good headaches. They're headaches I know how to get rid of in most cases. And I still get to interact with students. I still get to interact with the community. And I get to do something that I feel like is kind of in my lane. So, and that's important, you know, that there are very few of these jobs now that you can just do full time. You know, there is always some other additional component, it feels like. And, you know, I'm lucky to have a job that I feel like is one that I'm comfortable with, that I enjoy going to. And there've been some really good people on campus who've always kind of looked out for me because they appreciate what I do on Saturdays and during basketball season.
Yeah, it's funny. People ask me nowadays, like, what would you do? Like, what's your advice on getting in the business? I'm like, get your MBA and find a flexible hours accounting firm.
And so I'll tell you this story. The reason I got into broadcasting, I loved John Ward. John Ward did Tennessee games for almost 40 years. In my opinion, he's the best that's ever done it. And anytime I got to be around him in any small way was like the top of the mountain for me. It was unbelievable. But he planted the seed, listening to him as a kid, this is what I want to do. I sat in a room with him as a 20-year-old at a broadcasting camp in Knoxville, Tennessee. There were 12 of us in the room. He walked in. He sized all of us up in about 10 seconds and said, okay, there's 12 of you here. Six of you might make it. Might. And then you're sitting here going, wait a minute, what? And he told all of us, don't get a broadcast degree. Get a business degree. Learn the English language. And if you can talk about sports, you can use that and your knowledge of sports, and you'll be okay doing this. But at 20 years old, I was young and stupid. Oh, but wait till they hear me. I don't need a business degree. They'll just line up to throw money at me one day. One of the greatest regrets of my career, Joel, I didn't get a business degree. I wish I would have gotten a business degree. I would have kept getting reps, because here's the truth. And I'm not trying to put broadcast and communication programs out of business here. I'm proud of the one I went to at Middle Tennessee State. I think it's wonderful. Does a lot of good for a lot of people. But here's the truth. If you want to be a play-by-play announcer, the only true education is to do it. That's it. At the very beginning of this conversation, way back, we talked about live streams and how that's changed a lot of things in terms of how people consume sports. I think it's great for the young people that are in high school, that are at small colleges. who are looking for an opportunity. Because it used to be when I was younger, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s, that wasn't a real thing, or it was a very costly investment to make it a real thing. You had to find a radio station or an athletic department that was willing to take a chance on you to give you that opportunity. And now you can create those opportunities because the technology, you can take your phone and you can sit there and do that. If somebody will give you the green light to broadcast a game, and you can do that now. It's just a different time, but the only way to do this and become proficient at it is just to sit down and do it and learn from the mistakes that you make. Share the audio. I would say the tape, but that's irrelevant now. Share the audio.
Send somebody a cart.
Send them a cart. Yeah, send them a cart or send them an acetate disc. You know, I just think that's it. You know, the reps are the biggest thing. And then for me, it was building a network of people that you could send something to them and they would be brutally honest with you about what needed to change. You can send something to your friends and your friends are always going to tell you that it's great. You can send it to people that you don't know who've been doing this for a long time that are willing to take a few minutes and listen, and they'll send you something back you can work with. There was a time when I was really afraid to do that because I was afraid of what the truth might look like on paper. And as I learned that that's the only way I'm ever going to improve, it changed for me. Two great pieces of advice that came from a broadcaster and a lawyer. When I was doing junior college basketball, Walter State Community College, Morristown, Tennessee, in 1998 and 1999, Charlie Terry was an attorney in town and was a big supporter of the college, the athletic department in particular. Charlie would bring a headset and listen to us do the junior college games. And I thought, this is a huge deal. Somebody cares enough that they're going to come listen to us do the game while it's happening in front of them. And one night after a game, Charlie stopped me on the floor and he said, let me give you a piece of advice. There's a lot of John Ward in what I'm hearing there, and there's nothing wrong with that. But you need to focus on being the first Neil and not the next John. And I had never thought of that. I was just trying to be good, and I knew John Ward was good. And if I parroted everything he did, then I would be good by default. And it forced me to start thinking in that way. Now, that was in the late 90s. I'm telling you, that message didn't resonate until probably about 10 years ago. I don't feel like I started to get really good at this until I was at the end of my run at Kentucky. At least I didn't feel that about it. The other piece of advice came around that time. Chuck Cooperstein, who does the Dallas Mavericks games, wonderful guy. I sent Chuck a tape or a CD. Sorry, I don't know that I ever sent a tape to anyone. I sent plenty of CDs. I sent Chuck a CD, asked him to listen. I said, just be brutally honest with me. Tell me what's wrong with it. And the biggest thing I got from Chuck was, I can't tell you how to do this, but here's the separator between good and great. Think about the best who have ever done it. And Vin Scully is the name that immediately comes to mind. Vin Scully is incredibly conversational. It does not sound like a dictation. It sounds like a conversation while the game is going on. And I'd never thought of it in that way. And now when I do games, that is the goal for me above anything else. Am I talking to the listener, not at the listener? Am I inviting them into the conversation that I'm having with Matt Wyatt and Jay Perry during a football game or with Coach Williams during a basketball game? That's the top goal for me every time. I don't know that I'm hitting it, but that's it. That's the goal. And then everything else kind of falls into place after that.
Neil, where do people find you if they're trying to track you down, listen to you, get more Neil Price in their life?
Oh boy, I don't know why they would want it, but on X, I guess is what we call it now. That doesn't feel
no,
right,
it's Twitter.
Does it?
It's Twitter.
Yeah,
as long
yeah.
as Twitter.com takes you there, it's Twitter.
When I was younger, being on X was not something you wanted out of your life. Okay, but on Twitter, at Hail State Voice, on Instagram, even though there's not as much about broadcasting, but if you want to know how I'm failing it as an amateur barbecue chef or any of that, on Instagram, it's at Hail State Voice as well. And if you want to listen, Varsity Network, any of the Learfield platforms are on there, including Mississippi State or HailState.com for any of our games. We'd be flattered if you'd join us.
Neil, thank you.
Joel, this is a bucket list for me, man. It is. And keep doing it. Keep doing it. Because, again, like I told you at the top, you're providing a great service for people who do what we do. There are people who need to learn, and I can't think of a better place to send them than here with the repository you've already got of guests in there. Of the 200 and some you've done, all but this one have probably been really, really good because of the people you've talked to.
Neil, I appreciate that. Thank you so much. This is
thanks, Joe.
It's fun to do all these. So I never lost on me that people take the time to share stories with me and chat with me and let me pick their brains too. So I appreciate it.